It's 6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
At least 21 killed in multiple explosions in Maiduguri. Zimbabwe's president boycotts a European-African summit. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. Multiple explosions near an oil depot in the Nigerian city Maiduguri killed at least 21 people Tuesday, including 6 suicide bombers. Officials said soldiers blew up 3 vehicles laden with explosives. A 4th car exploded, apparently set off by one of the bombers. A surviving attacker was arrested. Kenyan police have arrested hundreds of people following explosions Monday that killed at least 6. The newspapers say police carried out nighttime raids in the Eastleigh section of Nairobi, where the blast struck 2 restaurants and a women's health clinic. A member of parliament from the area, Yusuf Hassan Abdi, told VOA he wants police to conduct a thorough security operation while not committing abuses.
We have to call upon the government to protect the innocent, to protect the human rights of the people of the constituency, and not to punish the people of Eastleigh collectively. To profile the population and to carry out a fishing expedition. That we would not want to see.
No one has claimed responsibility for Monday's attacks, which wounded at least 25 others. Muslim cleric Abu Bakr Sharif Ahmed, better known as Makaburi, was shot dead Tuesday in the Kenyan port city of Mombasa by what authorities described as unknown assailants. He was a vocal supporter of the late al-Qaeda mastermind Osama bin Laden, and called last year's attack on the Westgate Mall in Nairobi, in which 67 were killed, as 100% justified. The Muslim cleric was on a UN sanctions list, suspected of having links with al-Shabaab militants, and accused of being a leading facilitator and recruiter of young Kenyan Muslims for violent activity in Somalia. Conflict, illegal immigration, and militancy are on the agenda of a European Union-Africa summit, which gets underway today in Brussels. More than 80 nations are taking part. Among those not attending, Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir, who's under international indictment for charges related to the Darfur conflict, and Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe, who boycotted because his wife was denied a visa. Here's reporter Sebastian Mofu in Harare.
Grace Mugabe is subject to an EU travel ban along with her husband, although Mr. Mugabe was granted permission to visit Brussels in this case. The travel bans date to the early 2000s when Western nations put sanctions on Mr. Mugabe and his allies for human rights abuses and alleged election rigging. Zimbabwe's Secretary for Foreign Affairs, Joey Bima, accused the European Union of, in his words, bullying Africa, and said the incident would further strain Harare-Brussels relations. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
The European Union officially launched its military mission to Central African Republic Tuesday. The 1,000-man force is to work with African Union and French forces to restore security to the capital, Bangui, wracked by a year of ethnic and sectarian violence. Meanwhile, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees says it urgently needs to evacuate 19,000 Muslims under threat in the country. UNHCR spokeswoman Fatoumata Lajoun Kaba spoke Tuesday in Geneva.
Anti-Balaka forces control major routes to and from Bangui, as well as many towns and villages in the southwestern part of CAR. They pose a threat to Muslims, in particular in the PK-12 neighborhood of Bangui, in Boda, Karno, and Berberati to the west of Bangui, and in Bosangoa further north. We fear for the lives of 19,000 Muslims in those locations. UNHCR stands ready to assist with their evacuation to safer areas, both within and outside of the country. The only thing keeping them from being killed right now is the presence of the French troops and the MISCA. And the tensions are such that it's just impossible for them to leave. They themselves are asking us to take them out of there, to evacuate them.
Residents of the Bangui neighborhood PK-12 are reportedly fleeing after a weekend attack by Chadian peacekeepers that killed at least 24 people. Many have headed to displaced persons camp in the city. The world's top-ranked golfer American Tiger Woods has withdrawn from the sport's first major championship of the year after undergoing back surgery. Woods played in every Masters tournament since 1995 when he was an amateur. A U.S. high school student, the son of immigrants from Ghana, has accomplished a rare feat, being accepted at all 8 prestigious Ivy League universities. 17-year-old Kwasi Anin wants to be a doctor. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News. Many of these stories found on the Internet. Our web address, voanews.com.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, April 2nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A European Union-Africa summit opens today in Brussels, despite calls to boycott.
There's been, of course, positions which have been taken, which is very healthy in these kind of situations. But as far as we know, most of the African countries are very keen to participate in the event.
Aldo de la Ricia is the European Union ambassador to Zimbabwe. Doctors Without Borders calls for stepped-up emergency assistance to South Sudan before the rainy season begins in fall. Muslims remain trapped in the Central African Republic town of Boda, and a Muslim cleric accused of supporting Al-Shabaab has been assassinated in the Kenya city of Mombasa.
I take him as another Islamic cleric who supports Islam and tries to make the religion a better thing, not like pushing people to join Al-Shabaab or all that.
Ali Juma is a Muslim and a local resident of Mombasa. Ghana police increased public protection after a number of unresolved murders. And Rwanda marks 20 years this year since the 1994 genocide. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The European Union-Africa summit opens today, Wednesday, in Brussels after African leaders refuse to heed calls by some countries like Zimbabwe to boycott or push for a postponement over allegations that the EU was dictating the composition of African delegates. Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe called for a boycott of the meeting after his wife, Grace, was refused a visa to attend. Mrs. Mugabe is on the EU's travel ban. EU Ambassador to Zimbabwe, Aldo de la Ricia, says more than 40 African heads of state had accepted invitations to attend.
The summit is taking place that we are expecting 40 heads of state and heads of government of the 48 African countries to participate, and 22 heads of state and heads of government from the side of the 28 member states of the European Union.
But is it not being overshadowed, Ambassador, by some of the countries that are saying they are not happy by the manner in which African countries were invited?
I think there's been much more rumors than actual problems. For instance, when there's been these recommendations by the Committee of the Permanent Representatives in the African Union that were united under the format of Political and Security Committee, they made a recommendation. And this recommendation was interpreted as a resolution, but it was just a recommendation, a non-binding one. And most of the heads of state and heads of government were not aware. They didn't mandate this committee to make this recommendation. So we're asking the different cabinets of the heads of state and heads of government, and none of them was aware of any possibility of postponement or even less cancellation of the event. So I think that there has been a kind of manipulation of the situation. There have been, of course, positions which have been taken, which is very healthy in these kind of situations. But as far as we know, most of the African countries are very keen to participate in the event.
European Union Ambassador to Zimbabwe, Aldo de la Ricia, was speaking with Chris Gandhi of VOA's Zimbabwe program. A Muslim cleric accused by the United States and the United Nations of supporting the Al-Qaeda-linked Somali militant group Al-Shabaab was assassinated late Tuesday in the Kenyan port city of Mombasa. His lawyer said Abu Bakar Sharif Ahmed was shot dead along with another unidentified man near the Shimo Latewa prison in Mombasa. Ali Juma, a Muslim and local resident of Mombasa, says the late cleric Sharif Ahmed was not an Al-Shabaab supporter. Instead, Juma tells me Sharif Ahmed was just another Islamic cleric who tried to make Islam a better religion.
Surely it's very sad what is going around. Well, it's not the first time a cleric to be killed in the same way, which happened today around late evening.
You said this is not the first time. Why do you think people are targeting the clerics?
They say that most of the clerics deal with the Al-Shabaab and all that.
And what do you think? Do you think the cleric Abu Bakar Sharif Ahmed was an Al-Shabaab supporter?
Not really. I take him as another Islamic cleric who supports Islam and tries to make the religion a better thing, not like pushing people to join Al-Shabaab or all that.
When you say that this is not the first time people are targeting Muslim clerics, who do you think is targeting the Muslim clerics?
It's not clear. Also, the media doesn't even say, like, what happened the first time, second time, to different clerics. Also, this one, till now, it says it's an unknown assassination which went ahead around Shanzu in Mombasa.
The late cleric is on record of supporting Osama bin Laden. Do you think that's why people might have targeted him?
That's what I also said to the past two clerics which passed away. It was the same thing. And now this is the same story which came up about the late Sheikh Abu Bakr Sharif Makaburi.
We hear that there was some rioting after the assassination of the cleric. And what happened?
Yeah, there are bits of riots around Majengo area and Bondeni. But then the police were sent to these areas to calm down people and to stop the riots.
How do you think the cleric was assassinated? Was he in an open place, in a car, or was he in his house?
I was not at the scene already, the way it happened. But what I heard on the media, he was in a car.
You said that he was not Al-Shabaab supporter. He was just trying to be a true Muslim. What do you mean by that?
His sermons, you know, at least you know about the sermons and everything, or his ways of life. And as far as I know him, or heard his speeches and sermons, it's not like he was supporting them.
Tell us again, what is the situation now in Mombasa?
Now tension is everywhere. Everyone is, like, afraid to be outside because the riots and everything. Apart from the police being around, the tension still is high. People are afraid any time the riots might pop up.
Ali Juma is a Muslim and local resident of the Kenyan port city of Mombasa. He was speaking with me from Mombasa. The medical aid group Doctors Without Borders is urging humanitarian agencies to speed up emergency assistance to South Sudan before the rainy season gets fully underway and roads become flooded and impassable. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Doctors Without Borders Director General Bruno Jochem has returned from a visit to South Sudan. He says aid agencies are racing against time to pre-position stocks of relief supplies before the rains come. He worries they may be losing the race. He blames much of this problem on rigid bureaucracies in the United Nations, various governments and donors' organizations. He says these systems are excessively slow in assessing needs and dispersing funds, and that it takes most organizations 3 to 5 months to get the money they are promised. Jochem says aid agencies need the money now while they still have access to people in need. Fortunately, he says, there are no political obstacles to dispersing aid in South Sudan because government and opposition forces are giving aid groups free access to all areas. But he says the security situation puts many areas out of reach.
You have probably close to 1 million people who are missing the planting season, who have left with their belongings, and who will not be able to harvest in a few months from now. So they will be very dependent, not only food assistance, but relief in general. Yeah, it's quite critical for both stocks, logistics, and emergency programs to be put in place to respond to this challenge in a few months down the line.
Doctors Without Borders runs a large operation in South Sudan. It has 340 international staff and 20 projects, 8 of which have started since fighting broke out between the government and rebels in mid-December. During his recent visit to South Sudan, Jochem says he saw that several of his organization's structures had been severely looted or damaged or nearly destroyed. In some cases, he says, field teams had to be evacuated. Despite these circumstances, Jochem says his organization is continuing to provide critical health services for thousands of victims of this war. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It's Wednesday morning, the second day of April, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Barty in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. The time on Daybreak Africa is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. Members of Parliament in Ghana have asked the police to increase protection for legislators and the population after expressing concern about the recent surge in unresolved murders in the country, especially in the capital, Accra. The police say their Criminal Investigation Division has launched an inquiry into the killings. Some Ghanaians, however, say they are worried since the police have yet to arrest anyone behind the murders. CFAS author, Director of Public Affairs of Ghana's Police, tells VOA's Peter Clotty that the Ghanaians are not used to the recent surge in murders.
So the police are doing a lot about this situation. Already, it is because the police are firmly on the ground and embarking on patrol day and night with mobile and foot, community and highway, that the crime situation in Ghana is at its barest minimum. The issue of killing that you have recorded is quite a recent development. The police have intensified patrol. We have intensified all our operational strategies to nip it in the bud even before it becomes a problem. I can say that what has happened is not anything alarming. It is just because Ghanaians are not used to this in recent times.
Some people say that there are some unresolved murders, especially in the capital, Accra, and they wonder if the police CID or the Criminal Investigations Division is on top of this to find the perpetrators of these crimes and bring them to book.
Sure, the police are on top. The CID is on top of the investigation. Except that you and I know that matters of serious crimes like murders, armed robbery and others sometimes take time to resolve them. But then I can assure you that every effort is being made to get to the bottom of these. I know for the first couple of such murders that we have recorded, some people are in court facing charges for having had any hand in them. In as much as it is worrisome, and as much as the police is concerned about a few incidents that have happened, we haven't reached a stage where people should throw up their arms in the air in despair. Comparatively, we have a safer country, but then we are not going to sit down on concern and let this situation degenerate.
How is the police engaging the Ghanaian population to reassure them about their safety following these concerns that they have raised?
I hope you may have heard about some police officers going on air to reassure Ghanaians that it has not reached any alarming proportion yet and that every effort is being made to nip it in the bud. A typical example, I can say that even physical actions have been taken to assure Ghanaians. Only last Saturday, there were some sweep operations in some cities, including Tema, where we recorded the latest incident of killing. And some people were rounded up, and they are being investigated. Police and other cities have taken up the challenge, and they are doing everything possible to bring the situation under control.
CFAS Arthur is Director of Public Affairs of the Ghana National Police. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Accra. In Western Central African Republic, entire towns have been emptied of Muslims. Some have been killed, while thousands of others have fled the anti-Balika militia who attacked them earlier this year as Muslim Seleka rebels withdrew to the northeast. In the southwestern town of Boda, thousands of Muslims are trapped as international troops struggle to keep a lid on tensions. Viewers and Look has this report from Boda.
There is an invisible wall now dividing the town of Boda. This Muslim man was shot when he ventured across it 2 days ago. On one side is the town's Muslim population. On the other is the Christian population, including the mostly Christian anti-Balika militia. Each side says the other started the fighting. It began January 29th, after the Muslim Seleka rebels left town. Dialogue has failed. Violence only eased when French troops established this border. They call it the Red Line, only it's not really a line, it's a circle, surrounded by anti-Balika. Boda's mayor, Mohammed Awal, a Muslim, draws a map.
Donc ici, là, on peut pas.
This goes to Bangui. We can't cross this bridge, and we can't go here. We stay only in this district.
Hunger is the top concern. Muslims can't get to the market. They say the anti-Balaka won't let Christian merchants come and sell food to them.
No medicine, no security. The anti-Balaka, they are killing. There is no food. Every day is to the cemetery. Every day we need fabric to wrap bodies.
Clashes continue in the bush. Muslims have been fleeing into town. This man says he walked 40 kilometers after being the sole survivor of an anti-Balaka attack that killed 20 people, including his two wives and five children. African Union peacekeepers from the Republic of Congo deployed to Boda at the end of March. Their commander, Captain Ghislain Singu, calls a meeting on the Christian side. He says his orders are to keep the peace.
Those who hurt the population, I will hunt them even if they go into the bush. I have the men and the equipment for that.
The chief of the anti-Balaka in Boda, Dopani Firmin, has a simple message. The Muslims must go, he says. That is the only solution. Locals get up to talk. They thank the anti-Balaka, and they repeat, the Muslims must go. Back in the Muslim neighborhood, some see economic reasons for this surge of resentment. Muslims control much of the commerce in Boda, including the gold and diamond trade. Some worry their homes and businesses will be destroyed if they leave. Still, many say they'd go if they could. Anne Look, VOA News, Boda, CAR.
As Rwanda marks 20 years since the 1994 genocide, a group of visitors from a U.S. Holocaust memorial are touring sites around the country, drawing connections between two of the worst atrocities in the 20th century. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports on the significance of memorials for confronting the pain of the past.
A wooden shelf stacked floor to ceiling with skulls and bones fills the back wall of the Interahamwe Church Memorial outside Kigali. It was here, a tour guide explains, that some 5,000 people were killed during the genocide of 1994. Coffins of some of the dead lie on the pews. The victims' ragged clothing hangs from strings tied to the ceiling. Angelique Mukapukizi was one of the few survivors of the attack here. A young mother at the time, she only survived because the killers who thought they were executing her did not realize after they finished hacking at her body that she was still alive. Now, bearing scars on her neck and arms, she tells her harrowing story to this group of visitors from the United States. As difficult as her experience has been, she feels it is crucial to tell the world what happened in this place. If someone comes to visit the memorial and asks me for the testimony, she says, I do it confidently. It is like showing him the history of Rwanda. We cannot hide it, and if he understands it, it can be a good lesson for him and the rest of the world. The group visiting this day knows full well the importance of learning lessons from the past. It is part of a delegation from the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington. Michael Abramovitz, the director of the museum's Center for the Prevention of Genocide, says one of the main functions of memorial sites is to ensure that history is not forgotten.
And we really want to focus part of our efforts at the museum on raising awareness, raising consciousness about the fact that genocide did not end after the Holocaust, sadly, and that we still have a long way to go in realizing our collective vision of never again.
Touring these memorial sites in Rwanda, he says, is a different experience from visiting a museum.
First of all, we are only 20 years after the genocide in Rwanda, and we're about 75 years after the Holocaust. And so what happened here is raw, and obviously there is no substitute for actually being on the place where these crimes happened. That's a very powerful thing.
There are numerous sites across Rwanda, like the Interahamwe Church, where the real bodies of victims are left on display and the walls still bear bullet holes describing unspeakable violence, powerful reminders to the living of the not-so-distant past. Ildefonso Karengera, director of Memory and Prevention of Genocide at Rwanda's Anti-Genocide Commission, says these emotional memorial sites give victims a space to confront the past and to find some comfort.
It takes them back to the period in which they were living during genocide, but in the same time also it is a relief for them because they can cry, they can express themselves, they can, say, they give testimonies of what happened.
Rwanda officially begins commemoration of the genocide on April 7th in Kigali, when President Paul Kagame lights a national flame of mourning with a torch that has been touring across the country since the beginning of the year. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Kigali.
It's 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. In an all-Malian affair, AS Real played Joliba in the group stage of the Orange Africa Confederations Cup, according to the Confederation of African Football draws conducted in Cairo, Egypt, on Tuesday. Congo-Brazzaville's AC Leopards face Ghana's Medeama. Tunisian clubs Etoile du Sahel and Bizertin play Guinea's Horoya and Zambia's Nkana, respectively. Elsewhere, Egypt's El Ahly engage Morocco's Difa Hassani Jadida. Ivory Coast's Sewe Sports and ASEC Mimosa encounter Nigeria's Bayelsa United and South Africa's Kaizer Chiefs, respectively, while Cameroon's Cotton Sport engage Angola's Atletico. Turning to wrestling, hosts Tunisia and Nigeria emerged winners of the men's and women's contests at the Africa Senior Wrestling Championships staged at the El Menza Stadium in the Tunisian capital, Tunis. Tunisia retained the men's Greco-Roman event title, amassing 73 points. Morocco had 58, Egypt 55, Algeria 45, Chad 26, Congo-Brazzaville 22, Sierra Leone 8, and South Africa 7 points. Tunisia also won the men's freestyle division with 67 points. Egypt had 53, Nigeria 51, Algeria 50, while Senegal and Morocco tied in fifth place with 38 points each. Cameroon amassed 35 points, South Africa 27, Chad 21, Guinea-Bissau 18, Congo-Brazzaville 12, Namibia 11, Madagascar 9, and Mauritius 4 points. Staying in Tunis, a significantly improved Nigerian team edged defending champions Tunisia in the women's wrestling event when they amassed 67 points. Tunisia scored 61 points, Cameroon 53, Senegal 44, Chad 26, Egypt 18, South Africa 17, Sierra Leone 9, Guinea-Bissau 8, while Congo-Brazzaville and Ivory Coast shared the 10th spot with 6 points apiece. Overall, Tunisia topped the medal table in the 16-nation contest with 7 gold, 5 silver and 5 bronze medals. Egypt placed second ahead of Nigeria. Algeria is fourth, followed by Senegal, Cameroon, Guinea-Bissau, Morocco, South Africa, Sierra Leone, Madagascar, Congo-Brazzaville, and Namibia in that order. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a great day. Our listener mail for this Wednesday morning comes from Mohammed Ahmed Mansour of Monrovia, Liberia. He says, Dear VOA, I think it's about time for the Kenyan government to do more to protect the lives of its citizens. The indiscriminate killing of innocent civilians is barbaric and is totally unacceptable and unjustifiable. The Kenyan government should get rid of all Al-Shabaab elements if they are to be free from these attacks. We thank you, Mohammed Ahmed Mansour of Monrovia, Liberia, for your comment. And please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Multiple explosions near an oil depot in the Nigerian city of Maiduguri have killed at least 15 civilians and 6 suicide bombers. Nigerian officials say soldiers blew up 3 vehicles laden with explosives, while a 4th car exploded, apparently set off by a suicide bomber. That's it for this Wednesday, April 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a lovely day, Africa.
Love African music?
Music time in Africa.
This is Heather Maxwell, and if you do, Music Time in Africa is the perfect show for you. Tune in to listen on the radio Saturdays and Sundays at 0900 2000 and 2100 UTC. You can also listen to the show day or night on the internet. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on Music Time in Africa. You'll find past and present radio shows and a link to my blog, African Music Treasures. This is Africa through its own music. Oldies, classics, traditional music, Afropop, and fusion. You get it all right here in one beautiful bundle on VOA's Music Time in Africa.